This is Dominic Preziosi, and I'm here with Griffin Olenek, who has recently returned from Rome, where he was covering the Synod on Young People, the Faith, and Vocational Discernment for Commonweal magazine. Griffin, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to ask you to set up for our audience, just talk a little bit about what this particular synod is, when it started, when is it expected to end, and the kind of structure it follows, and what's really sort of on the agenda and the purpose.
Sure. So this year's synod, it's called an ordinary synod, meaning it's not addressing any kind of specific crisis in the church, but it's addressing the issue of young people. So it's a meeting of bishops that is taking place in Rome all month. So it started on the 3rd of October, and it's going to run through the end of the month on the 28th. It's essentially a long, month-long, almost think of it like a retreat. It's primarily a meeting of bishops. That's what synods really are in the Roman Catholic Church, and there are about 260 of them. And they're aiming to discuss problems facing young people in the Catholic Church today, so the whole world over. Interestingly enough about this synod, there are young people participating directly in Rome. They're sort of on hand. They can't really vote in the synod, but they're there to make speeches. They're there to participate in formal and informal conversations. Really, the work of the synod is to kind of articulate what the problems are and also what the solutions might be. It's not entirely clear what those solutions will end up being at this point. As we're recording this, we're a little over halfway, almost two-thirds of the way through. So synod itself means journey, right? To journey together. So there, it's sort of, you think of it like a spiritual journey. And that's really, I think, what it is. They're in the process now of articulating not just what the problems are, but what the responses of the Catholic Church might be.
Okay. And maybe you could talk about, you know, you talked about solutions that they may be after, but what are the problems?
So the problems are manifold. They range from really simple ones like disaffection with dry liturgies, disaffection with homilies, a sense of not being welcomed, which I think many people can identify with.
Not just young people.
Not just young people, no. So yeah, the sense of a general institutional lethargy. But then there are also the more serious ones, drug addictions, people from broken families, people who are growing up kind of without a sense of direction in life, specifically in the West. And then in non-Western countries, the fact that young people as extraordinary vulnerable members of society are subject to violence at greater levels. So victims of sexual violence, human trafficking, war, poverty, these sorts of things are starting to emerge.
So if we think of looking for an outcome from a synod, is that something we should really expect, something sort of concrete and quantifiable? Or what is it that we actually look for in the outcome of a gathering like this?
I think in terms of outcome, it'll be, well, let me just say, I don't know. In terms of a concrete, quantifiable, graspable thing, it's not going to be immediately obvious. And that's partly the way that synods are set up, is they have this long process of gestation. And if you think of the Catholic Church as the bark of Peter or kind of ship, it's really hard to change course. So you might expect, you think of the synod more as like almost like a party that happens on board the ship where the crew gets to know the passengers and that's sort of what's going on. So you can expect a kind of directional change, but you won't really see concrete policies. In fact, it's difficult to get concrete policies for a church that's so global.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we should be clear, it's not like something that's just a document that's issued and everybody suddenly sort of responds to this document.
No, and I think that's kind of the, I don't want to call it lazy, but the sort of, or even cynical presupposition that some people have is that, well, this is really just about another promulgation from Francis. That's not the point at all. In fact, a document could easily be ignored. It's not that it has to be implemented. So no, it's much more about, I think, empowering national bishops' conferences to feel emboldened that they can pursue new pastoral practices. So that's what you'd be likely to see.
So some of these contentions from some people who might be sort of critical or suspicious of the whole process, that they're saying that the outcome is a sort of a foregone conclusion, that really there's just going to be some sort of stage managed process and some statement that will be made at the end, but there's not really anything conclusive or substantial coming from this. Is that a valid kind of a reaction to what's happening?
To me, that's not very valid. That's certainly not the sense that I got on the ground. Again, it's sort of like saying, well, if you go away on retreat, the outcome is preordained. That's not true. It means it neglects the work that's really taking place there and the genuine excitement that's happening. I got to speak with several synod delegates, one of whom was on the drafting committee, and his work was just beginning. He looked like a person who was deeply excited and enthused about the work that was taking place. And really, I mean, not only has he been listening to people in the aula, the main hall where everybody meets, but also the small groups, but he was listening to me. I mean, I'm not so young, but I do have, you know, I had thoughts on this and he wanted to know them. Mm. So it's much more, I think those kinds of opinions, and I think they are opinions, they're more founded in, let's call them ideological convictions than evidence.
Mm-hmm. You've written a couple pieces for us now, a couple dispatches from Rome. One of the things you talked about was an innovation in this particular synod in that there was actually the participation of young people.
Yes.
How many young people were there and actually taking part in this? And what was really the extent of their participation?
Sure. So the official participation of young people is somewhere around 30 or 36, and they have the position of auditors in the synod hall. So there are roughly, I think, 270, maybe 267 bishops that have voting rights, plus a couple of non-bishops. And then the young auditors, they sit as a block in the hall. They get to make interventions just like synod delegates, which are only 4 minutes long, and they participate in small groups. They're also active on the sidelines. So in terms of their participation, you know, I was actually pretty skeptical that they were really being listened to. But my sense is that they have an outsized impact relative to their quantity. So there's so few of them, but they're so vocal.
And how did you pick up on that? I mean, you say they're vocal, but what do you really mean when you're saying that?
Sure. So you get to sort of hear from them at press briefings where one young person will sit with two bishops and then two press secretaries. The remarks that they make are always really articulate, really passionate. But I also got to speak with one of the three U.S. delegates, Jonathan Lewis, who works for the Archdiocese of Washington. And you know, again, this is a person that works for the church. He's employed by the Archdiocese of Washington, but he was also fiercely critical. And so I had the sense that, you know, this was not at all a kind of stage-managed puff process, but was really a kind of deep engagement. And
so just for those of us who weren't there on the ground with you, when you say fiercely critical, what did that look like?
I think people were very honest. A lot of young people talked about their disaffection with the Catholic Church. And not just disaffection, they really named the critical issues, the sex abuse crisis being the most important, saying this has caused us to lose, if not complete credibility, a lot of credibility with the hierarchy. So to have, again, young people in the hierarchy meeting and expressing to each other the almost mutual woundedness, I think, is pretty rare.
And did you get a sense of the current crisis? I mean, obviously, for a number of us, this is not the first time we've experienced something like this. In fact, one of our frequent contributors, John McGreevy, has likened the 2002 sex abuse crisis to a certain generation's Vatican II. It sticks out so much for them. Did you get a sense this year in 2018 among a gathering of young people in Rome that the crisis was hanging palpably over the session?
Yes. I think hanging palpably would be a good way to describe it. It was the first thing on everybody's mind. It was something that our delegation from the USCCB raised through Frank Caggiano, Bishop of Bridgeport, Connecticut, in the Synod Hall the very first day. But I also want to say that it's not simply something that's hanging over us. It's not just a source of powerlessness, but it's actually become, because it's an elephant in the room and it's so heavy, it's something that can be dealt with immediately. So people are just jumping right into it. So it's almost not just that it's hanging over, but people are walking through it at the Synod. And that was, I had so many conversations about sex abuse when I was there that were not infuriating or that were not trying to shut off conversation, but in fact, many, both bishops and delegates that I spoke to said, well, could you please tell us more about what you think and be honest? Mm. And that's Francis's desire for the synod, is that, in fact, the church's main problem is the lack of honesty. So if it could learn honesty by talking about the hardest thing, then it would go a long way towards a more relational, a more positive church.
Hmm. A more recent piece of writing, Griffin, that you've done for us, which I think you put together about midway through the synod, and you remarked on another difficult issue that the bishops will be addressing, and that is the migrant crisis. Mm-hmm. And I think you said the synod was sort of shifting gears and beginning to take up this issue and focus
yes.
on this. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So the first week of the synod, a lot of introductory remarks, a lot on sex abuse, as I mentioned. But as you got to the middle of discussions, which follow the processes mapped out in the Instrumentum Laboris, the working document, there was this increased attention to young people that suffer various forms of violence many of this happening in non-Western, non-highly industrialized countries. And refugees and migrants are paradigmatic of this experience as a whole. So they're some of the most vulnerable people, not only because they're young, but because they have no homes, they have no property, and very little relationships. So many bishops were bringing this up. And not just bishops, there was also the superior general of the Jesuits, Arturo Sosa, who spoke movingly about, this is the other day, about the fact that by paying more attention to migrants and refugees, specifically because they're at the margins, that's where the church needs to be. It's really indicative of Francis's papacy, where he wants the church to go out from itself. And so those are the people that are, in a way, they're at the center of the periphery. So that's why they're being talked about.
Yeah, of course, we remember in 2013, Francis going out to the peripheries and sort of almost literally when he visited Lampedusa, where there had been a recent, I think, there's multiple deaths of migrants who'd been attempting to cross the Mediterranean. And I think that was a very inspiring moment for many of us, for many in the world. And it's a sort of a very vivid recollection that I think a lot of us have. Something's changed in Italy since then, though, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. And I picked up on this. I had lived in Italy in 2006 when I studied abroad in Bologna, and again in 2015 when I lived in Tuscany. And, you know, there has always been kind of latent, I don't want to call it racism, but let's call it cultural distrust of migrants and refugees in Italy, but nothing like the levels that we're seeing now. In fact, Lampedusa used to be kind of front and center in the Italian consciousness of something that the country does right. It rescues all migrants that come. Those news stories have disappeared. This was what an aid worker with the Centro Stalli, run by the Jesuit Refugee Service in Rome, a refugee resettlement center, told me that. In fact, in the public consciousness now, they do not want to hear the migrant side of the story. They're really just hearing the rhetoric of Matteo Salvini, politician from the Northern Lega, which pursues
formerly the Northern League.
Formerly the Northern League. Yeah. Now it's just called the League.
Right.
But their idea is nationalist, and it's a bit like Donald Trump, but it's got its own differences because it's Europe, because it's they're much more on the front lines, let's call it, of the refugee crisis because of their close border in the Mediterranean with Africa. So I noticed a lot of, just to call it xenophobia, real fear of the outsider. And that's something that the Synod as an international gathering is trying to demonstrate a different way.
And you detect that tension when you're there. Obviously, the new government that came into existence in the spring has taken some concrete measures already.
Yes.
And did you feel that tension there while you were in Rome?
I did. I mean,
actually, and talk about some of those measures too. I mean, maybe some of our audience isn't fully aware of what's been going on.
Sure. So Salvini came to power back in March when the Lega won the elections, the general elections in Italy. And over the summer, there was a kind of notorious refusal to allow a Coast Guard ship carrying 177 migrants to disembark at a Sicilian port in Catania. And they were eventually received by Spain. But this was sort of seen as Salvini's stand, that Italy was not going to be what he called
something has changed.
Exactly. He said, you know, Italy is no longer going to be the world's migrant camp. I mean, he uses really, really ugly language to describe this. But just recently, the Italian parliament passed a law specifying that asylum seekers, which in fact applies to many people coming from Africa seeking asylum, it's now easier to deport them. They're not going to be given what's called a permesso di soggiorno, a permit to stay, which is something that I had easy access to as a college student when I studied abroad. Mm-hmm. Now they can't get it. And then there's also this really gruesome detail that I noticed, that in fact the police are going to be allowed to use tasers on any immigrants that they deem to be resisting arrest. So it's really this, Salvini is taking these very decisive steps, essentially to perform this gesture of being hostile to immigrants. And the Italian people do not have a problem with it. I was speaking with a young person, Sara, whose father is a famous journalist. She works as an intern with the Vatican's migrants and refugee section. And she was telling me, I was surprised at this. I said, well, how can it be that, you know, Italy, this country that prides itself on its Catholic heritage, on welcoming the stranger, how can these attitudes have hardened so fast? And she said, well, people don't really put together their faith and their politics. They have no problem. Even people that work at the refugee center, they'll say, well, I like individual refugees, but I'm still going to vote for Salvini because I don't want more of them coming. So it's really this strange schizophrenic mentality that's on display. I still haven't quite got my head around it.
Sure. You know, in your piece too, Griffin, you mentioned an encounter with a migrant from Albania, and you tell her story, and I think in a very vivid and sort of moving and compelling way. Can you talk about her a little and how you came to know her, and also talk, I think you describe her coming to Italy and sort of her encounters with the Catholic Church in Italy as well. And maybe
sure.
you could sort of talk sure. about that a bit.
Yeah. So her name was Durata with an H, she told me, which means gift in Albanian. And that's actually a typical name that I've worked briefly with refugees in the past, and many were named Gift. Anyway, I met her at the Centro Stalli, where she now works as an educator, working for a program called Finestre, which means windows. That is, they take former refugees who have integrated into Italian society, and they bring them into schools and universities to get to know students, to give them, to, they call it a sensibilizzazione, to make Italians more sensitive to the concerns of migrants. Her story, she's now 28. She was a college graduate and everything, but when she was 7, her parents emigrated from Albania, fleeing the genocide persecuted by Slobodan Milosevic. About midway through the Adriatic in winter, the smugglers that they had paid to take them to the Italian coast essentially told them that they had to abandon ship. They were cast off into the sea. They were rescued, fortunately, by the Italian Coast Guard. They were brought to Bari in the south, and they moved up to Rome, where she grew up in extreme poverty. And she said the most difficult thing about being a refugee in Rome was, I mean, beyond just the outright hostility that she faced, was the fact of seeing her parents almost reduced to children. Mm-hmm. Like, they couldn't really take care of her. They couldn't get through the bureaucracy. So she had to do everything. Mm-hmm. She herself was young. She's also very smart. So she was able to quickly assimilate and navigate. But yeah, she spoke a little bit about her trauma and how she had overcome it. And how, you know, after having moved her way through Italian society, which I can tell from her firsthand experience as an American in Italy, is quite difficult. Mm-hmm. People are not very willing to let you be an Italian unless you're an Italian. But she had passed for an Italian. In fact, I mistook her for an Italian. And she suddenly decided, after she was working for a few years as a teacher in Rome, that she could not remain indifferent to mm-hmm. what was going on. She saw the news reports. She did a volunteer year and then began working at the center. And she had the sense of calm and peace that mm-hmm. kind of radiated from her, that in fact, she loved the work that she was doing despite its difficulty. Mm-hmm. And it was her, let's call it, her woundedness, her trauma, that, and her assimilation of her own trauma that enabled her to make that available to mm-hmm. other people, to young migrants coming now. So she's involved in the church, but she had, in a way, both positive and negative things to say. Her family was aided by a priest when they were living in an abandoned shack growing up in Rome. And what she said to me was instructive, that the priest came to them. It's not that they sought out the priest, but that the priest had heard that they were living there and came to offer them food, but also to integrate them into the activities of the parish. So that was her sense with the synod, too. She was interested in what was going on. She had been to see the Pope, but she said, really, you know, they need to get out of the parish. Enough with these parish parties. Enough with parish events. Go out to where people are, the people mm-hmm. that are not Catholic. Mm-hmm. Go and serve them. Mm-hmm. That was kind of her message for the synod. And then she just went back to work.
Incredible. And do we think that same message has been heard by the synod? Do we think that that's going to be something that comes from this? We talk about outcomes. Will they go out as opposed to having people have to come in?
I hope that they do. My sense was that at least many of the U.S. bishops are ready to do this. They want to do this. They recognize the predicament that the church is in. They recognize that the church cannot afford to lose an entire generation of young people because there will be no church in the future. Mm-hmm. And I think my sense is that they're ready to begin experimenting. So how do you experiment? You go out and do something different.
Exactly. The synod ends on October 28th, and Griffin's writing. Griffin is our assistant editor at Commonweal, and he's written a number of pieces about the synod, which are available on our website. Griffin, thanks for being here.
Thank you.